The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 14th of November, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, and he covers First Group. News from them, down a bit today, actually, at 16% last time I looked. Burberry, BRBY, 3i Group, plus Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain and cryptocurrency news. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, if you do receive an RNS via our app, Vox Markets app, if you haven't got it, is free to download from the App Store, and you can get RNSs via notification. That means it comes to the front screen of your phone, okay? And you can swipe, open them up, and if you get an RNS and you like the content of that, please do hit that thumbs up button there, and it could feature on this podcast, of course, sharing the news more widely and on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. Chris, thanks for coming on. What's happening
out
there?
Well, there's lots of exciting things happening. I mean, you know, some quite big moves actually in terms of the larger cap areas. What you've got is things such as First Group actually, which is sort of been a funny old stock over recent weeks and months. You've had the management say that they could upgrade or sort of break up the company effectively. You had an activist investor saying they could do exactly the same thing. And then lo and behold, you know, that shot the share price up over recent months. But today they've come out and said that's all still ongoing. They're not changing the numbers for the full year, but there's so much red ink adjusted numbers and everything else, including they've got a range of assets, obviously trains in the UK, buses in the UK, but also the Greyhound buses in the States. And the Greyhound buses have once again had various one-offs, sort of losses and write-downs. There's been some issues around insurance costs in the States as well, even saying at a geopolitical level, things such as immigration has hit some bus travel aspects. So, you know, all a bit messy in the States and a bit of red ink. And the share's been a last little bit down 15-16% to, you know, not much more than a pound after kind of most people concluded that breakup value was sort of 130, maybe more pence a share. So an excitable one today. Come a bit off the rails, I guess you would say.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking at the figures here, and they're saying that adjusted profit before tax, 28.7 million compared to 42 last year, which was down 35%. So hang on, operating loss this year is 118.
That's right.
This half, the H1 2019, 118. They made a loss, 118 million operating loss. Last year it was 46 million profit. So that's a big drop.
That's right. No, it's all these write downs. And as always, whenever you see, this is the trouble of, if you like, one of the problems of fundamental analysis. What on earth is the number? What number should you be looking at? You know, that's one problem. When you've got write-downs, and as I say, they've written down aspects of their business around mostly their bus operation in the States. You know, that, you know, the way you account for it, that on your headline profit and loss, that impacts. And obviously we've seen many companies come out with losses as a consequence. So all a bit messy for First Group. And people have obviously said, oh, hang on. Yeah, I don't like the look of this. This sounds a bit iffy. What I would observe is that what is, number one, this plan, be it from the company or be it from activist investors to want to break it up, still seems on track. you know, the company got religion on that a few months ago, kind of agreed with the activist and sort of outflanked them by obviously suggesting their own plan. Yeah. That's still on track. Number one. Number two is that debt is usually the killer. Debt's been a real big issue for First Group. This is why they don't pay a dividend, and this is why the shares are in the toilet. If you go back, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years. But actually, if you look at the debt line, it's now, you know, it's what I would call modest in the wider scheme of things. It's certainly been a lot worse historically. You know, they are still generating cash flow to pay off that expensive debt that they still have. Plus, they can refinance over time too. So I would say if you look at it, yeah, buses, trains, some of these areas are not the most exciting in the world. However, there is a little bit of sustainability in things like school bus transport. They've got some great contracts there. So catalysts, red ink, sentiment all over the place, you know, a nice old stock market mess. I would say quite interesting as a, I thought this one was going to kind of, you know, exit quietly in the sense of they would break it up or something and, you know, the share would do its stuff. But it missed the market, may have given another opportunity here. So I'm quite interested, I must admit, despite all the red ink at prevailing share prices.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I was just looking into the cash flow and just say that net cash from operating activities, 331 million compared to 228 for the last half. So, yeah, there's debt there. Yeah, so whenever you see this, though, I mean, I would suggest always. I saw it was a company. I had a company on the yes in the podcast, and they've discovered, you know, millions of barrels of oil, which the share price has done very well. But then they've had analysis, and it's heavy oil, and now the share price dropped off a cliff because people think, oh, it's a commercial, and it's always worth waiting. You know, I see people jumping in yesterday on a 50% drop. You know. But it's always worth waiting, you know, the share price to settle down, because it will settle down and bottom out. You know, nothing will bounce back up in a V, you know. If it does, it'll come back down a little bit. It'll find a level. So I'd say to people thinking of jumping in on the dip, always wait a couple of days. So you can always wait, can't you? Let the share price settle down a bit, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, the three-day rule, you know, the three-day rule was that famous one where the bad news or whatever it might be comes out on day one. Day two, it's in the newspapers, because obviously back in the day, newspapers weren't fancy things like podcasts or internet delivery. Newspapers were the way many people got their information outside of the small clique. So you'd have a secondary fall as people reacted to what they read in the newspapers. And then the third day would be when, you know, those final, perhaps old duffers who finally got around having a look at it, their broker just about got in contact with them or whatever, they then sold and formed the bottom. You know, that was the old three-day rule. And actually, it still holds, because in a weird way, in our internet-delivered world of perfect information and everything else, of course, there's too much information and it still takes time for people to react. And of course, the psychology of the market, waverers who perhaps on day one think, oh, you know, I'm still cool with this. On day two, they've lost their nerve and then they sell, and then that creates a psychological bottom. So, yeah, as always, you know, you don't need to do something immediately, typically. If you feel pressured to do that, then maybe it's possibly the wrong decision.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Okay, that's First Group. What's next, Chris?
Well, a couple of property names to briefly mention, or property-related names. One is 3i, which is well-known as sort of a private equity, one of the first sort of pioneers of a private equity and related investing in the UK, being a very popular FTSE 100 constituent for a while, investing in a bunch of pre-lists or related companies. I've actually done a very good job. But the shares are down, when I last looked, about 5% today. Half-year numbers seem pretty reasonable. NAV, net asset value, was up about 10, 11%. Which, you know, in today's world, you think to yourself, actually, that's not bad. That's progress. That's pretty good. That's way better than, you know, Neil Woodford's grappling with pre-listed companies and whatever else. However, and there is a however, it's kind of interesting because the shares are trading at a big old premium. It's not massive. It's sort of, you know, 12, 13% premium, even after today's move. And I think therein lays the issue, really, because the love up for 3i shares has kind of been quite high. And I think today's numbers were all right, but just kind of okay. It's almost like the trouble is when stuff's trading at a premium, people are saying, yeah, you know, we're expecting gangbusters performance and everything else. And this was kind of all right, but just not blowing the socks off. So I think hence the reason to the move today. I also note that if you look at the share price, the share price has struggled. You know, it's yet to really definitively push above that 10 quid level. And, you know, law of round numbers being what it is, if you have a sort of something like a big level like £10, you know, the share has been trading above that and it's still above that. But you can imagine a lot of people are sort of saying something on the lines of, oh, yeah, you know, I like the company, but, you know, when it falls below £10, then maybe I'll take a look at it. It had that kind of feel to it too.
Yeah. Do you know what's odd there? This share price dropped today, the gap down. It's just gapped down below where previous support has been, which is oddly at 1060. I don't know why. It's had previous support and resistance there. And that's just below. Now, it's right on the 200-day moving average, which is normally seen as a you know, generic bull bear line above and below. So if it can hold above that, maybe it's good, or above that 1060. It's at 1063 at the moment. So if it can hold above that, maybe it'll hold a support. But if it doesn't, then they grind lower, you know?
It's, you know, I have to say they've done a good job. They're quite dependent on a couple of investments. As always, these things tend to be. They've had a couple of big winners which have helped out. But yeah, do you really want to pay a big premium for them? I'm not sure about that. And particularly when, you know, there are other things in the sort of the broader space where you can buy at a discount. Even though it's property centred, it was striking also you had Great Portland Estates out today too, which typically, as all these property companies are, trades at a discount. You know, and obviously Great Portland Estates, it's a mixed-use property developer, you know, bit of everything basically in their portfolio. But they're trading at when I last looked, a 12-15% discount to net asset value. You know, then their NAV edged up in the numbers out today, you know, just a couple of percent or so. But, you know, at least showing positive movement compared to, you know, dogs that we've talked about before, such as Into, which is obviously focused much more on shopping centres, which is much more problematic. But, you know, I think it goes to show again that in a world where you can find property or investment company type things which are trading at a discount, paying up for 3i, you know, 10-12% premium to NAV, you know, even with the progress that they're showing, I'm not sure. I think I would wait and sort of see how they're progressing.
Cool. Anything else there, Chris?
Final one has to be a bit of luxury, and Burberry's come out with some numbers today, and they've kind of reiterated everything. The shares are nicely up when I last looked, 5-6% on the day, pushing up again towards the highs of July, and that all looks great. And what was fascinating about their commentary, the numbers didn't look anything particularly special or surprising. They did name check Hong Kong and saying Hong Kong operations were, you know, being impacted by some of the issues that you can see on the TV screens at the moment. But of course, and clearly that's patently obvious, but clearly, as with many other luxury names, China is much more prevalent and relevant and impactful on the numbers than Hong Kong per se. So, interesting comments from Burberry. No surprise what they said about Hong Kong, but also kind of no surprise that actually the movements in China are much more influential and impactful upon their share price and comments. As it happens, I still have some Burberry shares. I took some profits actually in the excitement of the early summer period at a share price perhaps a touch ahead of where we are today, but not very far ahead. So, you know, it's interesting to see the share come back to these levels. But I have to say, I'm not seeing a lot of natural value at the moment, albeit, you know, they are a great brand and the Chinese do seem to love them, which is not a bad combination.
Yeah. And I don't know how, thing is, I don't know how, what influence, I mean, Hong Kong of course is a big, big place, but what's the size of the market there? I don't understand how much. I mean, I understand China's a big market for them, but Hong Kong's a small part of that. So,
the thing is, Justin, people used to go to Hong Kong. It was a bigger market than, if you like, the local population would say, because be it the mainlanders would come to Hong Kong to shop, or go to Macau maybe to shop, or it could be that obviously you'd have a lot of travel retail or related through it. But that is naturally fading off for obvious reasons. The Burberry have shops in Shanghai and Beijing and other places in China China now. But it's also obviously the double impact, which is fewer Chinese will go to Hong Kong because of the issues at the moment. They can shop on the mainland. Yeah, Hong Kong is withering as a proportion of sales, but it's still, you know, a biggish market, you know, expensive, wealthy population, lots of expats, etc. It's not a bad ground. It never has been a bad ground for luxury groups. But yeah, I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, you go back a few years, name checking the Hong Kong market having, you know, violence and issues and challenges would not have been good, would have been a big, you know, mega negative thing for these luxury names. Not so more.
Yeah, well, people used to go to Hong Kong to shop. Now you're more likely to get shot the way it's going on. It's awful what's going on there, isn't it? And in it, but it's dreadful. But you know what? China itself, though, I mean, I don't know if you saw the figures out this morning, but industrial production rose 4.7%. That may sound good, yes. But the median forecast was for 5.4%. So that's about a 13% miss. And what's worse, really, they said that retail sales was back near a 16-year low and fixed asset investment growth was the weakest on record. Now that, when you get those kind of, you know, weakest on record, that is, you know, it doesn't get worse than that, does it really? You can't get worse than that, you know?
No, that's right. I mean, two things. I think that fixed asset growth was the weakest since 98, which is probably when about the modern day records were started. So, you know, it's a 20-year low if you wanted to be pedantic. But clearly, the Chinese economy has changed an awful lot over the last 20 years. And sometimes the massive historical positioning of statistics might be a little bit non-insightful. I do generally agree, though, that China is clearly slowing. Most people would kill for those sorts of numbers in terms of economic performance. But, you know, as always, it's what's baked into people's hopes and expectations. And my interpretation of the numbers was that actually the Chinese authorities were going to keep policy loose. And, you know, that's obviously something which we're seeing worryingly in a lot of places around the world. People talking about the need for looser policy after a decade when we've had loose policy.
Yeah.
Where does it stop, hey, Justin?
Exactly. Marvellous stuff. Chris, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, the crypto trader, with his snazzy book in a kind of purpley-orangey electro style. Who decided on the style of that, Glenn?
That was the publishing company.
Okay.
They decided on that. And I quite liked it because it stands out. It's not, you know, most book covers are kind of austere these days.
Yeah.
They look very sensible. Whereas my cover doesn't look that sensible. It's got a big picture of my face for a start.
It's a picture of it, but it's got almost electro stripes. Are they taken from some kind of graph? They look like that HODL graph. Have you ever seen the HODL graph or the HODL wave? Have you ever seen those?
Yeah, I don't think it was taken for that, but I take your point. It's kind of like the letters are splintered, aren't they? Which kind of, that's the idea. It's like crypto, it's technology, it's bits and bytes. It's, you get the idea.
Stuff. Okay.
Yeah, you're clearly really impressed. I'll pass your comments on to the publishers.
It does stand now. It's quite colourful. It's very nice indeed. Now, since we last spoke, Bitcoin prices have moved again. It does. You know, we said last time it's boring at the moment, but then it hadn't moved for a while. And I think I said, if you look, it doesn't really go 20 sessions without a major move. You know, it does move, you know, maximum 20 sessions, and it moves.
And you were right.
And, but you know what? Again, I was going to say I get sick of being right, but I don't. I wish I was more right. But do you know what? I've lightened my load of Bitcoin a little bit. I've scaled out a little bit. Because at the moment, I'm just seeing a temporary downtrend. We got the MACD rolling over, the RSI getting weaker. It's below the 200-day moving average. Maybe being supported now by the 50-day moving average, which is about to curve up. But, as yet, what's your thoughts, Glenn, on the Bitcoin price?
What I'm seeing, Justin, in front of my eyes here, is a small channel within a larger channel. You remember we've been talking for months now, really, about how after Bitcoin quadrupled in price earlier this year, it's been trending slow, like grinding its way slowly downwards since the beginning of July, and it's formed a kind of a channel or a sort of downward sloping flag, technical analysts would call it. But whatever you want to call it, it's the price shot up, quadrupled in price, and then just slowly making its way downwards for a few months since. And actually, most of the rise is still intact. It hasn't even eaten up. Has it even eaten up half of the rise that we saw earlier this year? No, I don't think it has. But anyway, the point is you've got this downward sloping channel, but then within that, you've got the last month or so, which is what you're looking at, which is another little downward sloping channel within the larger one. So the question is, because we're now at the bottom of the range of this little mini downward sloping channel, normally we would expect that to then bounce back up. But if it doesn't, if it heads on downwards, then we're heading down to the bottom of the grand channel, which at this point in time would be about $6,800 would be the lower point of that large channel. So
what are you saying? How much?
At the moment it would be $6,750 approximately would be the bottom of the big channel. So if somebody is a swing trader, say, then that would be the point at which they'd start buying, around about $6,700, if indeed it ever reaches that low again.
Today, Glenn, it's the 14th of November, and as we all know, approximately, because, you know, a block is created every 10 minutes, so approximately, they reckon the next halving, reward halving, will happen on the 14th of May. So that is exactly, if I do about December, January, February, May, 6 months. That's half a year away, exactly 6 months now, until the halvening festival, as we all know it, and we'll all bring our halvenings into school and put them around the front of the stage there at assembly. Traditionally, last two, if you'd taken a position 6 months before and held for a year afterwards, so if you held for 18 months, if you'd hodled, as the Bitcoin community says, if you'd hodled for 18 months, you'd have seen very decent returns indeed. And they reckon November generally is quite a bullish month for Bitcoin. So will it start to move? We're going to have to form a base here somewhere, because at the moment, like I said, it's just going sideways. Not a bad thing when you consider that move, like you said, we had in June. It was a stellar move, wasn't it? It was like, three times the value.
Yeah, it started in April, and by the beginning of July, it had gone from $3,500 to $14,000. So what's that? It's about quadrupling, isn't it?
And I was looking at the volume bar on that day of the top, and you realise, and it's basically on my TradingView chart here, it's basically all green. It's the highest volume you can see on that one big day, which is nuts, really. The highest day of the year, of the last, in fact, last couple of years, isn't it really? But so people were buying. The open and close there on that day, right, was $11,700 was the open, $11,760 was the open, and the close was $12,920. So people were buying, expecting to go to the moon there. It never did get above that level again on a daily close. It closed down the next day, so it closed at $12,920, and it closed the next day at 11,953, and started basically grinding lower, a series of higher, lower highs and
higher lows. Lower lows.
Lower lows, yeah.
Lower highs and lower lows.
And that's been basically what's. I realize that kind of congestion where people just bought crazy on the highest day of the year, that congestion is probably still there, or it's just coming out of the system now. People are selling, because if you look at now, it's 8,600. They are underwater, by over 30%. So
exactly, which is why people always that's why the from a psychological point of view, that's why the lower highs always happen during a period like that, because after you've had a massive burst of buying at the peak of a market, whether it's Bitcoin or any of our traditional markets, they all work in much the same way, don't they? So whether it's the dot-com boom or the crypto boom or whatever, you always get a peak of small buys at the very top. And some of the large sellers are selling out. They're the people picking up the stock. Are selling the stock at that point to the masses, as it were. Yeah. And those masses, as you say, they're from that moment on, they're underwater. So there are a lot of people who bought at the end of June who are just facing daily pain, and their pain gets worse and worse. And every time there's
a
kind of... But also, whenever there's a peak, whenever it gets up a bit higher, say to around, what was the last peak? The last peak we had was a few weeks ago at about 10,350. A lot of those people then sell just out of relief that at least they've got some of their money back, because they're, you know, they've put up with months of being underwater. And for some people, that's a bit desperate from a financial point of view. So that kind of perpetuates the selling. As you say, the congestion is very, very hard to break once you've had a major peak of buying like that. There are so many people who are just waiting for the right moment to sell.
And it's odd. In fact, you see, that peak we had back then, I did say the biggest volume for the year, that's previously, but that volume was beaten on a buy side, well, it was beaten anyway, on the 26th of October when we had that massive up day, you know, that, what was it, 30% up day, really?
Yeah, that's the one I was just referring to, 10,300.
It's odd, isn't it? People just chase. A lot of people just chase, I suppose, traders, is it, or people just punting, or because, you know, if you believe in a company, you should try and get a cheap price, not buy at a high, you know, which is odd. Which is
Like you say, it happens very, very quickly. Within the space of a few hours, the price went from about $7,000, where it touched the bottom of that grand channel that I'm talking about. So that's when the swing traders all started buying, was at around, what was it, $7,300. They all started piling in, and the price went up so quickly that once the swing traders have done their job, then the position traders start looking at it and going, oh, that must have been the bottom. Look, we're experiencing such a huge rise. And of course, because it all happens so quickly within a space of hours, you don't really have time to kind of soberly think it through as a position trader and think, right, is this really the proper low? Is this the best time to buy? You just kind of, well, a lot of people anyway, just kind of panic and just go, it's now or never. I've got to get in now.
Mm-hmm. Hence
the buying. And that, of course, pushes the price up even further. And then it, before you know it, it's gone from 7,300 to 10,300 within the space of a handful of hours, less than a day. Mm-hmm. And once it reaches that peak, then obviously at some point the levee breaks, as it were, and the selling begins, and then people who'd just got in start panicking. Some of them sell. People who, the swing traders who bought at 7,300, they're all selling as well. And before you know it, you're back into that old channel, which is where we are right now.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts at the moment? I mean, are you holding? What's your position there?
In Bitcoin, I am waiting. I'm still on the sidelines. Though because this channel has such big ups and downs, I have got in and out a few times in recent times, and of course I think I was bemoaning on last week's podcast that I missed, because I was speaking at a conference, I missed that big jump from 7,000 to 10,300, which I was so upset about, because that would have been a lovely little trading opportunity. Yeah. But anyway, I've done all right. I can't complain, considering that there's no real action.
I've done all right, Gav.
That all right? How would you like it if I talk about a different crypto for a change? We don't often do that.
What?
Yeah, not Bitcoin.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Because I bought another one. You've asked me what I've been doing. Well, I bought another one. Link. Yeah. I don't know if anybody's heard of this one.
I'm sure
really
some people have.
Yeah, some people have. The people who work for it.
Apart from you. Just you knows about it.
Just me. I'm in the know. It's called Chainlink is the name of the crypto, but the code is Link, L-I-N-K. And basically this is a really interesting one, because it's gone from being absolutely tiny to being one of the biggest in the world. It's worth more than $1 billion already, and it's on the rise. You know, I like the chart. You know that I only buy things where I like the chart, but I also like the actual company itself. And I think it might appeal to someone like you, because I know you bought shares. Was it Argo Mining?
I did buy it. I go back out there.
Because you're into the whole kind of picks and shovels idea. The idea that when...
The reason why I go into Argo Mining is because I essentially, you know, reading more about Bitcoin and quite like the idea of it, the thought of it, the lack of supply, and it's available in an ISA, of course, Argo Mining, because they're AIM-listed. So you can get them in ISA, and all my shares are in ISA. But since, I thought, hang on, why don't I just you know, get access to the asset, Bitcoin, if it is an asset, rather than get access to the company that mine the asset. Now, if you get access to the company mining the asset, then there's a lot of other complexities, like, for example, their balance sheet, how they're in the business, that gets in the way of the asset, you know? So it's like owning a gold miner rather than owning gold itself. If you can own gold yourself and you believe in it, why not own gold? If you know...
But, are you telling me you've sold Argo mining?
Oh, yeah, sold a long time back, yeah. And decided to dump them in place of just getting a bit of Bitcoin. But, I mean, the disadvantage is I'm about to come outside my tax wrapper, the ISA wrapper. So you
ventured outside your tax wrapper.
I very rarely venture outside my tax wrapper. Very rarely. I like to stay inside that all the time. But I thought, well, let's just grab a bit of Bitcoin. Who knows? Let's just buy a bit and hold, and maybe sell a bit and hold, and buy a bit and hold. But yeah,
all right. Well, maybe you might not love my theory so much then. But well, no, I think you still will, because I know you like you like to think about the picks and shovels theory. Nonetheless, you know the idea that
valid,
I mean, it's worked in many booms in history, of course, where people, for example, the railroad boom and also the automobile boom, electricity boom. You know, whenever a new technology is invented, often you make more money not so much by investing in the companies that actually produce the products, like the car manufacturers. Most of the early car manufacturers, of course, went bust pretty quickly, but you can actually make more money by investing in the tools that they need.
Picks and shovels, in the
sense of gold mining, or with automobiles, it would be buying, Pirelli or
wasn't it a case of the first to become a millionaire during the gold rush was the person selling the picks and shovels rather than the gold prospectors. I think that was the fact, you know. So, and in fact, they were not, the person, the main guys supplying all the stores, the stores that held there, went on to become very well off. I can't think of the name there, but the person was the first person to become a millionaire was the person supplying the kit, not the person mining for the gold, you know. So,
yes.
Yeah, going for it. Anyway, go on,
well,
go
exactly.
On.
Like right now, for example, I know people who are making a lot of money selling Bitcoin mining equipment. You know, the actual specialized computers that you use for mining the Bitcoin. They're probably making more money than the actual miners themselves. But anyway, the reason I got onto this company Link and bought Link, Chainlink rather, and bought Link the tokens, is because they are a kind of picks and shovels company. It's quite a hard one to understand, so I won't go into too much depth, but they are a middleware company. They are trying to bridge the gaps in the new blockchain technology. There is a thing called smart contracts. Are you familiar with smart contracts?
Yeah.
Come across that term. So, a lot of blockchains allow people to make contracts with each other through using code. And it's thought that technology will help us revolutionize all kinds of industries. One that's easiest to explain probably is insurance. For example, at the moment, you know, you go through insurance companies to get your insurance, you give them your details, blah, 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 you sign a contract or at least, you know, give an email saying, yes, I agree to have this home insurance. But with smart contracts, everything is automated. So you would have, for example, standard home insurance contracts, which are enforced through the blockchain. You pay the money for the insurance, the contract is signed, and everything about it is automated. So for a start, you would not necessarily have to deal with even an insurance company. They could be locked out of the whole equation, which would mean we wouldn't have to pay the profits and the expenses of these enormous insurance companies, which would, in theory, make insurance a lot cheaper because it would all be automated through the blockchain. Now, to cut a long story short, there are various problems with this system that Chainlink have come up with a good idea to solve. Middleware, as I say, is what they produce. It's in between the software on one side and the software on the other side, and in between various bits of hardware. So that's why you call it middleware. The idea is that they would be able to help these smart contracts work more efficiently in ways that are too complex for me to go into in great detail right now. But I've checked it out, and personally, I'm impressed with it. And what's more, the price is going up and up and up and up. It's one of the most positive from a technical chart point of view. So that's why I bought that one. I just thought I would tell you about it, not to promote it, because I don't for a second flatter myself that by talking about it right now, it's going to make any difference to the long-term price of it, which is what I'm in it for. But I think it's worth talking about. And if it's all right with you, Justin, I'll do that in future weeks from time to time if I come across an interesting crypto that I think is worth telling people about.
So what's it called again? What's the title? How big is it then?
Let's have a look at the current market cap. I think it's about $1 billion.
What is it, Chainlink? What is it?
Chainlink, but the code is LINK. And it is currently, I'm just looking down, it's the 14th largest cryptocurrency in the world. $1.1 billion market cap, yeah.
Okay, circulating supply. Total supply is, circulating supply is 350 million. And
oh yeah, you'd be impressed with the supply as well. They've come up with quite a good algorithm to cap it. Yeah. Okay. What's more, the way it works is that the more people, the more companies make use of this product, of the middleware that is being produced, whenever they use it, they have to take possession of and spend a certain amount of LINK tokens. And so basically, the more companies make use of this technology, the scarcer the LINK tokens become, which should put upward pressure on their price in the long term. That's the theory.
Okay, cool. When you say middleware, I sort of just, you know, clothes or stuff you wore around your middle bit, you know, like belts.
Like a corset.
Well, okay, yeah, corset or belts. So if you're selling that on the, you know, I think it'd be quite good, actually, middleware, because you've got underwear, you've got overwear.
A chastity belt, maybe.
Middleware. Well, just a website sells middleware. Anything that goes around your waist or your middle area. Could be anything. Could be high pants, for example, or belts.
Like this. Yeah.
Anything goes around the middle, you know. Excellent. Any other news you got from anything about Bitcoin or blockchain or anything like that? What's going on?
Yeah, a couple of Bitcoin world things going on at the moment. China is, you know, it's been making positive noises about cryptocurrency for a while.
Is that positive, China?
Yeah, that kind of thing. The latest news out of China is even more positive. We've been hearing that basically on one of their biggest newspapers, they had as a front page story, Bitcoin is the first successful application of blockchain technology, and blockchain technology is set to change the world and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, it's not so important what they actually said. It's the point that this is one of the main state-run newspapers, and it prints a front page story for no apparent reason, because it's not really front page news, but they decide to sing the praises of Bitcoin, which I
essentially
thought was...
The Chinese state media, they want to keep your eyes on what they want you to keep your eyes on. So they don't want you looking at Hong Kong. They don't want you looking at any trade worries, because their figures out today are not very good either. I mean, it's something like retail sales are the worst in 16 years from China. Industrial production is down. They estimated to be growth about 5.4%. It's coming at 4.7%. And investment in fixed assets is the worst on record that's come out. So they wanted you to look at stuff that they say, this is all good. We're into crypto now. Don't worry about the trade stuff. All Hong Kong imploding. People should be getting shot in the streets or getting burned. Crypto's good. Thumbs up from us. It is a massive endorsement of the technology. And of course, you know, I think it'll help something like Lead Dog Bitcoin. Because we said before, I think Bitcoin will become the US dollar of crypto, which it pretty much is. I think, in fact, it's more influential, isn't it, than the US dollar. If you look at all fiat currency exchange on the world, I'm sure the US dollar doesn't take up 68% of all transactions, whereas Bitcoin does in crypto world. So I think any beneficial effect with blockchain technology being adopted, it'll spill over into Bitcoin, you know?
It seems likely, yeah. It ain't going anywhere anytime soon, by the looks of it.
Yeah.
And let's just move on to my last story of the day, which is an interesting one that anybody can look up. If you fancy something fun to read on the way home from work or something, go to vanityfair.com. They've got a big article from their latest edition of their magazine, the December edition, The Big Bitcoin Heist. And, I mean, you might have heard about the you've mentioned in the past that podcast, The Crypto Queen, The Missing Crypto Queen. Which is, yeah, exactly, that's very popular. But this is something completely different. This is the Big Bitcoin Heist, and it's about Iceland. Iceland, the country which has, I think, the fewest criminals in the world per head of population. They have a total prison population of less than 1,000 people for the entire country.
Isn't that because there's less than 1,000 people there?
Possibly. Quite possibly. But anyway, you know, it's one of those countries where you can keep your doors open at night and nobody steals
your
stuff.
But you wouldn't, though, because it's so cold. You've got to keep the doors closed.
Very good point. But there is one baddie, it seems. And this guy, who is now is safely in prison, is called, what was his name? Stefan something or other. I've forgotten it. Hold on. What's his name? Stefansson. 32-year-old Mr. Stefansson.
Son in the end.
So basically, because I actually mentioned this in last week's podcast by coincidence, that Iceland is one of the countries where Bitcoin miners go to do their mining. Because they have to open massive warehouses full of high-powered computers.
That's the problem. They've left the doors open to keep it cool, and crime beans are low.
They do, you see, in these places, because they're huge warehouses full of expensive computers, they always have at least night watchmen, you know, security guards who wander about and that kind of thing. But in Iceland, because they were so kind of complacent, because nobody ever commits crime there, they had all these massive Bitcoin warehouses running all these powerful computers, and they were pretty lax on the old security by the sounds of things. So this guy, Sindri Thor Stefansson, to give him his full name, he basically goes and allegedly steals hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these computers. And he did it not just in one warehouse, but went from warehouse to warehouse with his gang, because he'd put together a gang of other Icelandic ne'er-do-wells who all have fantastic names. There's Petter the Polish, Haffy the Pink, and this is my favourite guy, Victor the Cutie. Which I'd want him in my gang, definitely. Got to have Victor the Cutie. So this gang, between them, they all managed to steal tons and tons of these computers. It took ages to track them down, but eventually the police tracked them down, put them in prison. But one interesting thing is, because Icelandic prisons are so relaxed and so lax, so kind of liberal, the guy actually escaped from prison just by climbing through his cell window. Simple as that. He got out and he went to Sweden, and then they had to get Interpol onto the case to get him back, and now he's back in prison. But anyway, it was fascinating, because the reason they stole all these Bitcoin mining machines was not just so that they could sell the computer equipment, it was so that they could set up their own Bitcoin mining operation and make tons and tons of money. And the computers have still not been found. There's a mysterious Mr. X. Nobody knows who the Mr. X is, but the criminal Stefansson, he claims that he did all this for a mysterious Mr. X, who has now supposedly got all these hundreds and hundreds of computers and is mining Bitcoin probably and making tons of money as we speak.
Okay. And it's quite surely it's this day and age, it's all, well, it's been caught, isn't it? But it's all traceable, surely, if they start using stuff like that. I mean, there's a digital footprint, isn't there? Fingerprint, even?
It was interesting, because the way that the police tracked them down in the end was not so much through using really, really modern technology. It was more kind of traditional routes that they went down. You know, simple things like, I say traditional, CCTV, that kind of thing. Photographing the criminal driving nearby in a van that he had recently bought. And, of course, they could trace the license plate, stuff like that. So they didn't have to use sort of digital footprints from Bitcoin mining or anything like that. They just tracked him down using old-fashioned detective work.
Do you know why Icelandic names are very interesting? So they've always got sun on the end of them. You know, the males have sun at the end. And do you know what that is? So if you're a father, right? Let's say you're the father and you're called Glenn Goodson, right?
Yeah.
And you give birth, you have a son. Your son would then take on your first name as a surname and add a sun at the end. So they'd be, so if you added, so for example, it'd be Glenson, his surname would, and his first name would be something else. So if you, you know,
well, Glenson. They're, well, I mean, my name's Goodman, but a common name in that part of the world is Gutman's daughter, which is, I guess, translates as Goodman's daughter.
Yeah, Goodman's daughter. The son would be Goodman's son. So it would be Glenn's son. So Glenn's son and Glenn's daughter. That's the surname would be. So they take your first name, and that's used as a surname. With the son or daughter added in the end.
It would be Glenn's daughter, wouldn't it? Yeah, Glenn's daughter.
Yeah, so it's... but surely you didn't... Why do they need to have that? It's just like, you know...
I don't know.
It's especially if you are... You know, if you're the son or daughter of a multi-billionaire, you live in their shadow anyway. If you're the son of, like, you know, Bill Gates or Richard Branson, then you always are Richard Branson's son or daughter anyway.
To add your name to it,
Richard's son, you say, oh, you'd never get out of the shadow ever, would you? Name about it, so it's annoying. But here we are. It's a bit of Icelandic stuff. It's education, isn't it, eh?
It is. They're all in prison. Victor the Cutie is in prison. I forgot to mention he's called Victor the Cutie because he's apparently gorgeous. I've been trying to find a photo.
He's gorgeous.
Not for any strange reasons, yeah. But just because I'm married, you know. Yeah. I'm not into Victor the Cutie. I'm a married man. But nonetheless, I wanted to see how could he be so good looking that he's called the Cutie. That's what I want to know.
Have you looked
at it? If anyone can track down a photo, I'm just curious.
Hang on, I got pictures of them. Gorgeous son. There's one there, Stephenson. Sendry, who's the other one?
Stephenson, he's the main guy, yeah, exactly.
There's one below.
Yeah, he's pretty good looking. So, well, I mean, they're all kind of Nordic, aren't they? So they all look like Adonis's.
What surprised me, Glenn, is...
Mind you, Adonis was Greek, so maybe it's not...
You're a regular reader of Vanity Fair. This is...
I'm not a regular reader, but yeah, I mean, Vanity Fair has some pretty interesting articles in it, actually.
Yeah, okay, you don't need to be defensive. You can be
good magazine. Hey. Nothing wrong with Vanity Fair.
You can be. People confuse it with Vogue.
It's nothing like Vogue. It's like an intellectual magazine, Vanity Fair.
Glenn, you're very defensive on this. Wow, touched a nerve there. Okay, Glenn, Vanity Fair, Goodman. Thanks very much for that, and we'll chat next week, and hopefully you give us more stories from Vanity Fair.
Yeah. I'll have all the list.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Xeros Technology Group. XSG. What a mess they've made of that company, the fundraising. What, 81% discount to the current share price. They still haven't got the fundraiser away, and it's dwindling. At four, Keffi Minerals, up 10.55% to 1.736 pence. That's Keffi there. At three, Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, down 11.36%. ECO, ticker there, of course, 58.5 pence. At two, it's Expediator. Of course, Stephen was on the podcast yesterday. Revenues this year about 200 million, 5 million pre-tax profit, and this is a bit of a bad year for them. So, you know, they're still growing by 11%. Last year's have seen 54% and 40-odd% and 60%. And Stephen did say they'll carry on growing next year. They're just having growing pains this year a little bit. And next year they'll carry on growing. Has ambitions to hit 500 million in revenue within 3 years. And then a billion within 5 years. Valued at, what, just 50 million market cap at the moment? And number one most followed company, up again today, Tissue Regenics Group, up 17.78%. TRX is ticker there. Okay, top five most liked RNSs came from the following companies. At five, it's Barren Oil, proposed reverse takeover and suspension of trading. At four, Volex PLC, half-year report of Volex PLC. At three, Beximico, pharmaceuticals. A result, first quarter in, ended 30th of September. Easy for me to say. At two, Oriole Resources. Nearly said the wrong word then. Strategic update. And number one, Jangada Mines. Further, 1 million received from Valor. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.